It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the battle over Ukraine continues. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The showdown over Ukraine began last November when then-President Viktor Yanukovych spurned an association agreement with the European Union in favor of closer ties to Russia. Moscow had strongly opposed the EU deal, which would have anchored Ukraine, a former Soviet republic, in the West. What began as peaceful demonstrations eventually turned deadly as protesters clashed with police and Mr. Yanukovych fled the country last month. Russian President Vladimir Putin lost little time in flatly rejecting the constitutionality of the fledgling interim government in Kiev, in violation of the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, under which Russia, America, and Britain guaranteed Ukraine's integrity in exchange for the country giving up its nuclear arsenal, and despite warnings from Washington and Brussels, Putin engineered an invasion of Crimea, part of Ukraine's sovereign territory. He did so under the pretext of protecting ethnic Russians, who comprise about 60% of the Crimean population, even though there was no evidence that they were under threat. The local parliament voted last week to split from Ukraine and join Russia, and scheduled a referendum for later this month. U.S. President Barack Obama condemned the referendum and signed an executive order that authorizes visa and banking sanctions on those responsible for violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. President Obama affirmed that the United States and its European allies are working in lockstep.
And today in Brussels, our allies took similar steps to impose costs on Russia. I am confident that we are moving forward together, united in our determination to oppose actions that violate international law. And that includes standing up for the principle of state sovereignty. The proposed referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian constitution and violate international law.
President Obama went on to say that any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine and that, quote, we are beyond the days when borders can be redrawn over the heads of democratic leaders.
While we take these steps, I want to be clear that there is also a way to resolve this crisis that respects the interests of the Russian Federation, as well as the Ukrainian people. Let international monitors into all of Ukraine, including Crimea, to ensure the rights of all Ukrainians are being respected, including ethnic Russians. Begin consultations between the government of Russia and Ukraine with the participation of the international community. Russia would maintain its basing rights in Crimea, provided that it abides by its agreements and respects Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And the world should support the people of Ukraine as they move to elections in May.
Meantime, both Washington and Brussels have offered economic assistance packages to Ukraine exceeding about $16 billion. President Obama, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and other senior Western officials have said that the West prefers to settle the issue with Russia through dialogue and de-escalation. But so far, Vladimir Putin seems impervious to such entreaties and even prepared to intensify the confrontation. The entire region is on edge. Poland called for consultations under Article 4 of the NATO Treaty, which provides for consultations when members feel threatened. Other former Warsaw Pact countries are also unnerved by Russia's occupation of the Crimean Peninsula. The showdown over Ukraine is being dubbed one of the most serious East-West confrontations since the Cold War. Well, for much more on the crisis in Ukraine, its potential destabilizing effect on the region, and its impact on U.S.-Russian relations, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Andrew Cutchins is Senior Fellow and Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. And Matthew Rajansky, he's Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. That's a policy group also based in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Matthew Rajansky, let me begin with you. Let's go back and try to figure out, what does Vladimir Putin want? What is motivating him with regard to the incursion into Crimea? Your take on his provocative moves.
I think there are several layers of interest here from the Russian side. First and foremost, obviously, is Ukraine. You can't separate the events in Crimea in the last week from the larger story, which is that Ukraine's now had a revolution. It turned out to be a violent revolution. It turned out to be quite a significant change. You had, obviously, President Yanukovych fleeing the country and being replaced by what had before then been the opposition, as opposed to the kind of middle ground constitutional transfer of power that was envisioned in the EU brokered negotiations. Under those circumstances, I think there's a real concern from Moscow that they will have lost their ability to leverage into Ukrainian politics. And so this is a strong signal to the Ukrainians going forward. Hey, look, we need to be taken seriously. We want to continue to be able to effectively veto Ukraine's path in joining the European Association Agreement, potentially in the future joining the EU, certainly joining NATO, which has been a big Russian concern for a long time. There's also a major Russian domestic political factor here, which is that it is absolutely true Russians and Ukrainians are historically close to each other. The two societies read each other's media. They're both very large Eastern Slavic countries. And of course, Putin asserts a kind of leadership over East Slavs, more than just Russians. The Ukrainian church is very important to his image in that respect. And his concern, I think, is, so here you've had a major popular uprising, which has deposed a leader who seemed in many respects to be following Putin's model, a power vertical, agglomerating assets around himself, using authoritarian means, ultimately using violence against the protesters. Well, if they can succeed in Ukraine, then the question that many in Russia have raised is, why not in Russia as well? And I think that's a bridge too far for Putin. He cannot accept that.
Turning to you, Andrew Cutchins, to get your take on what is motivating Vladimir Putin. No question, Ukraine is critical to its identity. It's a country that bridges both the East and the West. I'd like to get your take on the fact that he has gone this far and what else is at stake.
Well, let me put it in a little more colloquial terms, perhaps. Putin is really mad.
Okay. That's an understatement.
He was really mad that the February 21 agreement fell apart.
This was the agreement that the EU and the
Americans,
brokered.
The Russians observed, and the Russians did not sign on to it. But in retrospect, they seen that as kind of the status quo they want to get back to, but that's absolutely impossible. Anybody who looked at the February agreement should have understood, though, there was virtually no chance that Ukrainian people would accept it, that Yanukovych could not stay in power for another 10 months until December. You know, I think that Matt nicely laid out some of the motivations behind Mr. Putin, but I think his great miscalculation is that if he does indeed view himself as the leader of the so-called East Slavs, I really don't think that most of the East Slavs outside of the Russian Federation look to Vladimir Putin as their leader. And if there's any silver lining that has emerged out of what's taken place in the last week, is that the Ukrainians living in the East and the Ukrainians living in the South, where there is a higher percentage relatively than in the west of Ukraine, but still a minority ethnic Russian population in Ukraine, they are much more united today than they were a week ago. And in that respect, Putin may very well find himself that, yes, he will have Crimea, whether it's in a kind of a de facto independence like Abkhazia or actually joining the Russian Federation, but he will have aided and abetted, I think, a much deeper antagonism more broadly in Ukraine against Russia. I think it's unfortunate in general because Ukraine is a country with some identity challenges because of the East-West split. It's a little bit too simplistic, but I think that Putin, if his goal was to try to send a signal to Kyiv and the Ukrainian government, I think it was deeply counterproductive for his interests in the long term, but time will tell.
Well, speaking of sending signals, Matthew Radzhansky, he's sending a signal to the West as well. This is my sphere of influence, and you, the European Union, trying to get Ukraine either in an association agreement and eventually membership, that is just a bridge too far. Talk about how Ukraine, what is going on, is symbolic of wider trends, that Russia's attempt to assert itself on the world stage and basically recreate to some extent, you know, the former empire through the Eurasian Economic Union and so forth.
I don't accept the notion that Putin is neo-Soviet per se. That said, I think that he draws, again, and this comes to domestic politics. Remember, Yanukovych is an object lesson in how vital managing perceptions and managing political trends in the country can be to survival. And so I think for Putin, it is vitally important to demonstrate that he's a man of his word, that he's a man of great vision, that he's a man who channels, I think, the greatest precedents of particularly the Tsarist era, much more so than the Soviet era, although some of the kind of comfortable themes also of the height of Soviet power, that is, work was predictable, vacations were predictable, pensions were predictable. And I think, therefore, for Putin, the project of Eurasianism as a response to liberal democracy, European integration, American-led security arrangements in Europe, I think that project is vitally important to his credibility. Now, ironically, I agree with Andy. I think he's lost more than he's gained by this particular maneuver. I think it was a misstep and a miscalculation. But I think in his mind, and I suspect going forward, most of what he is after is to preserve the credibility of this arrangement that he's already begun to build. He's got Kazakhstan in it. He's got Belarus. He's reached out to Kyrgyzstan. He's pressured Armenia to declare their intention to join. So it's not rebuilding the Soviet Union or even the Tsarist Empire per se, but it's demonstrating on a domestic political level, Mr. Putin has a vision, it's a serious vision, and it's one he can deliver on.
Turning back to you, Andrew Cutchins, what about the U.S. response? Has the United States, have the Europeans calibrated an appropriate response with the sanctions, the visa restrictions? Is this the cost to Putin that President Obama talks about? How effective do you think the response has been by the West so far?
Initially, I was very critical of the Obama administration, going back to Mr. Obama's February 28th press conference, the talk about costs. And the first thing that came out of the White House was discussing not participating in the G8 in Sochi. And my thought was, geez, don't you guys remember that 2 years ago, Vladimir Putin did not even bother to show up at the G8? I think that pretty much said what Mr. Putin thinks about the G8 and what he thinks about President Obama more broadly. Subsequently, this week, I've been pretty impressed with the work of the administration. Mr. Kerry's trip to Kyiv was good. It was symbolically important that he carried this $1 billion package in assistance. And of course, these assistance packages are always overvalued for what they actually are. The EU package, for example, $15 billion, is even more sort of mythical than real. But it's almost more of a political statement at this point in the game, because nobody has a really clear assessment as to exactly the magnitude of the near-term needs for the Ukrainian government. And we're talking about the possibility of bankruptcy in Ukraine before the May elections. There's also been activities that we've seen out of NATO, which I think are important, because as bad as Crimea is, we have to ensure that Mr. Putin clearly understands that any similar action involving Russian military or self-defense forces, quote-unquote, outside of Crimea in other parts of Ukraine is absolutely unacceptable. This kind of action taken by the Russians sends very, very, very deep shock waves to any of its neighbors. And this step was really sometimes I've called it a quantum leap, a dramatically more extreme measure, even if you compare it, in my view, with the Georgia War 6 years ago. At least in the case of the Georgia War, he had a provocation by the Georgian government that Mr. Saakashvili foolishly attacked Russian forces. In this case, there's absolutely no provocation whatsoever in Crimea. And what's so incredible to me, actually, is how restrained the Ukrainians and the Crimean Tatars have been in Crimea, and the Ukrainian government at large.
We'll get more in a minute. First, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Andrew Cutchins, Senior Fellow and Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, from whom you just heard, and Matthew Rojanski. He's Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. And I'm your host, Carol Castiel. We're discussing the crisis over Ukraine as Russia continues its provocative territorial moves. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com. We'll be establishing a Facebook page very shortly. But first, here's a shout out to Prasali Mamima Sonadara. She's a loyal listener in Sri Lanka. Well, back to you, Matthew Radjanski. I would like to get your reaction to U.S. leadership, to the EU measures with respect to what's going on. On the one hand, of course, they're trying to bolster Ukraine with an economic package. But what about the visa restrictions, sanctions that President Obama announced and the European Union? So from your perspective, has the West fashioned an effective approach to de-escalate, to defuse this crisis?
Well, I think solving this problem needs to take place on multiple levels. So one level, of course, is just preventing it from getting worse. And the worst that I imagine is you have actions on the ground. It can't be predicted and can't be controlled because an accident could happen, someone could get killed, and then very quickly things spiral out of control. So that needs to be stopped, and that's about getting international observers, either OSCE or UN, in place, on the ground, separating out the forces and actually having transparency about what's going on.
Do you think Putin will accept that?
He's expressed a willingness in principle to do that. Now, again, whether he can compel the forces on the ground to act, because there are such a variety of interests now being represented, right? Now you've got the local so-called Crimean authorities who've gotten way out ahead, in a sense, even of the Russians, in saying, look, we're independent, we're demanding loyalty from all the Ukrainian police and military units. These folks are now traitors in the eyes of Ukrainian law, and yet at the same time, nominally, the Russians are saying, we do respect Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, which is definitely narrowing that off-ramp. But for the short term, at least get the observers in place. I think that should be feasible. On the geopolitical level and the Ukrainian domestic political level, you're going to have serious negotiations. But then there's even the higher level here, and this is where you got to go back decades rather than just months. That's reconciliation. I'm not saying Mr. Putin's motives are not entirely cynical. I'm sure they are. He doesn't personally feel threatened, except in the Russian domestic political context. But the fears of ordinary Russian saatechistvenniki, for which there's not a perfect translation, sort of brotherly peoples living in Ukraine, those are driven by historical experience. When they talk about fascists from Western Ukraine, it's a reference to a time in World War II and after where there was an armed uprising in Ukraine where Western Ukrainian nationalist units were in fact killing Russians, but they were also killing Poles and Jews and others. And there's a painful memory there that has never yet been dealt with because it was locked down by the Soviet system. And then the 20 or so years of post Soviet Ukrainian independence, it's always just been a football that gets kicked back and forth and manipulated and abused by both sides in order to claim full power and authority for themselves. So there really needs to be a process of reconciliation if you want to have a sustainable future for the country and for the whole region, including the Russians.
There's no question that there are probably these memories, and there are elements in Ukraine who are anathema to perhaps Putin and Russians. But really, the protesters and the new government are trying, at least from what I can see, have tried to bend over backwards to assure the Russian-speaking population and others that they are not out to threaten them. But that said, we spoke with Angela Stent recently, an expert on Russia and Eurasia, who wrote a book, The Limits of Partnership. And she said that it's hard to translate win-win in Russian. In other words, what the United States and the Europeans would like seems to be a sort of a win-win. We're not saying that Ukraine shouldn't have any relationship with Russia, but rather would like the Ukrainians to, you know, be able to determine their own future. But it doesn't seem that that's part of Vladimir Putin's vocabulary. He seems more of a zero-sum game type of person.
Yeah, you know, in the Russian culture, there's the phrase "kto kavo," which basically means it's, you know, one against the other. And even if both sides were to win, one side's going to win more. And that means the other side effectively lost. So that is a very kind of deep-seated approach. And there's enough history for Mr. Putin and others in the Russian political elite to be very skeptical and cynical about Western aims. Having said that, Matt is right. There are going to have to be, you know, diplomatic discussions and negotiations.
Back to you, Matthew Radjanski. Let's just say that for now, Crimea will be in the Russian camp somehow, but we'll have to see how things play out. What's the next step for Vladimir Putin? Do you see him going further in terms of power grabs in eastern Ukraine?
Well, you know, I think one of the unintended consequences for Russia of this particular move, much more so than Georgia or than Russia's presence, for example, in Transnistria, which is in neighboring Moldova, they've been there with about 1,500 troops for 23 years, is that the ability to use soft power with anyone but a very small slice of ethnic Russians living outside the borders of Russia is almost nil now. So I think actually he's narrowed the space for his ability to advance this vision of a Eurasian Union, or even just the narrower vision of a sort of East Slavic brotherhood, you know, Russians, Belarusians, Ukrainians, by alienating people who would have in some ways been his natural allies. And if you look at the kind of consequences in day-to-day life for ordinary Crimeans, I've been communicating with friends and with alumni of our program at the Kennan Institute in the region, and they're very pessimistic about the practical aspects of their future in this part of Ukraine. Now, Mr. Putin has done that to them, right? Nobody was pessimistic following Yanukovych's being deposed. When that happened, there was a moment of opportunity. And so I think from a very pragmatic perspective, what Putin is doing is he's alienating not just a new generation, but even sort of the current generation, people who still remember the Soviet Union and think to themselves, this is the worst aspect of the Soviet Union and not the good stuff that we recall, the stability, the relative prosperity, you know, jobs and so on.
Turning back to you, Andrew Cutchins, I want to turn to the potential geopolitical consequences of Russia's moves in Crimea and how it has really created tensions between the United States and Russia on the international scene, whether regarding policy towards Syria, Iran, and so forth. What will be the impact?
Well, from the Russian standpoint, Carol, Mr. Putin made it pretty clear in his readout of the discussion with President Obama, and they made a specific reference to that we don't want this major difference to have an impact on other things and that other interests that we want to cooperate with the United States on. Now, the Russians, because of their political system, are going to have a much easier time of walking and chewing gum, so to speak. And let's, the extent to which they can work with us together on problems, be it Afghanistan or Iran or Syria, you know, doing favors for the United States, they do it out of a cold calculation of their national interests. And I suspect that they would continue to do that. It's harder for us to engage in this kind of, you know, okay, we can maintain the cooperation on other issues despite this dramatic difference of views on Ukraine.
Matthew Rojensky, how do you see it? Can Russia compartmentalize, in a sense, just say, okay, with respect to Syria, Afghanistan, Iran, will work with the United States, or will there be some backlash?
I wouldn't say that Russia's entirely incapable of continuing cooperation in other areas, largely for the reason that, as Andy suggested, they have strong interests as well that they would seek to advance. For example, getting the chemical weapons out of Syria is something that the Russians have really staked a tremendous amount of credibility on, and they didn't do that for the United States. Making sure Afghanistan doesn't become a total basket case again and send drugs and mujahideen into Russia's soft southern underbelly, another major Russian interest. That said, the particular vector of cooperation with Washington is going to be iced over, I think, for a while. I think the Russians are going to respond disproportionately, if anything. But they made that clear to us back in 2012 when the United States, over human rights issues, imposed what's called the Magnitsky Act on the Russians, a set of sanctions that are not too dissimilar from what we're seeing now, visa bans, asset freezes, and then, of course, the political sanction of naming and shaming. And we're seeking to do a very similar set of things now. And the Russians at that time warned there will be a response. It will be disproportionate. And indeed, it was. They blocked all adoption of Russian babies by Americans. They practically kicked every American NGO out of the country. And there's been subsequently a major crackdown on American-connected NGOs. But there may be other, you know, dramatically disproportionate kinds of responses we'll see in the diplomatic or financial space. I think energy is always a two-way street, so it's sensitive. The Russians need to sell gas as much as others need to consume it. But I wouldn't exclude the possibility that they go that route as well. You know, remember, Putin thinks of himself as head of an energy superpower. That's one of the terms he consistently uses.
Well, speaking of energy, of course, there's a lot of talk here in the United States that the U.S. should ramp up its export of natural gas to Europe and so forth so that they wouldn't be as dependent on Russia in case it does do these kinds of things. But that's a subject for another program. One last question. Andrew Cutchins, any thoughts with regard to where this is going? And is there a possibility for bloodshed? How do you see this crisis in the next weeks and months?
There's absolutely a possibility of bloodshed. I mean, what is most surprising at this point is that there has not been bloodshed, in particular with the Crimean Tatars. I mean, you talk about an ethnic group that has a beef with Russia. This is the 70-year anniversary of the deportation of Crimean Tatars by Mr. Stalin to Central Asia, where half of them died on trains on the way over to Central Asia. So I would watch that very, very carefully. As far as the off-ramp is concerned, I have the image of the EU and the United States chasing after Mr. Putin with a ladder. but he's running on steroids. The distance between him and us is getting bigger. The last thought is that, I mean, for now and for the longer term, NATO has to make absolutely credible its Article 5 commitments to other Eastern European, and especially the Baltic states. And the question is, would he do something that would really be far more unhinged? He is very happy, I think, to expose NATO as some kind of mythical alliance, even though, on the other hand, he's so adamantly against and fearful of these countries joining it. It's sort of a deep schizophrenia on his part.
I'm going to have to give the last word to you, Matthew Rodzianski, regarding the way forward and how you think this is going to play out.
I just want to be clear. I think the government in Kyiv was absolutely right to be really clear about rules of engagement, to tell all their forces on the ground, don't fire, don't raise weapons, don't even have weapons, don't send special forces into the region, don't provoke a fight, because that's exactly what Putin has wanted. The one recording, we have a lot of recordings of Western officials that the Russians have leaked. The one recording we seem to have of Putin is him expressing shock and outrage that his strategy of provoking the Ukrainians, asking these unmarked forces to be provocative, somehow didn't result in them shooting, because that was exactly the justification that he would have needed to take further action in Ukraine, and he didn't get it. And that may be one of the reasons that we are looking at a potential diplomatic solution at this point. So that's what I would focus on. At the same time, it's absolutely right. The United States has to be clear in backing our allies, who are very concerned about their own security in the region. I'm a little troubled to see that a U.S. destroyer has now moved into the Black Sea. You know, that kind of signaling can be interpreted in multiple different directions. The option's always there. We obviously have got to back up our allies, and if things get worse in Ukraine, we need to be there physically to reassure the Ukrainians. Secretary Kerry being in the country was very wise. But first priority, get the OSCE, get the UN on the ground, separate the forces. Let's not have an accident that leads to an explosion.
Well, we'll be covering this story on Ukraine in the days and weeks ahead. Stay tuned to the Voice of America. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrew Cutchins, Senior Fellow and Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Matthew Rodzianski, Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Marty Curcius. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.